Welcome back to the AI Minds podcast. This is a podcast where we explore the companies of tomorrow built AI first. I'm your host, Demetrios, and this episode is brought to you by Deepgram, the number one speech-to-text and text-to-speech voice API on the internet, trusted by the world's top conversational AI leaders, enterprises, and startups, some of which you may have heard of. I'm talking about Spotify, Twilio, NASA, and Citibank. Today, we are joined by a very special guest, the CEO and co-founder of Deepgram itself. What's going on, Scott? How you doing?
Man, not much. Or a lot, depending on how you look at it. I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. Yeah.
Well, I'm excited to chat with you all about the inception of Deepgram, all the way into what it is today and the culture of Deepgram, because as we were talking about before we hit record, we've both got our point of views on the company. And so I think it would be really cool to talk about the different lived experiences that we've had. Maybe you can start us off with your journey and where you started in order to get Deepgram to become a thing. Like, it came from an idea. Yeah. What was that?
Yeah, we're 9 years old as a company now. And the first about 4 years of that was a deep research phase before we released our product at scale. And that's what a lot of people know us for, our speech to text in real time and batch mode and, you know, 30 plus different languages. And we worked on that from 2015 all the way up to 2018, 2019, and then released it. And that time period, it was just a really small number of people, like 8 people or less. And then after that was like the high growth phase of Deepgram, where, you know, we're hiring a lot of folks. There's a lot of people using us as our speech to text API. And then now we're the number one speech to text API in the world. And we have now expanded to other products as well, like text to speech. And now just in the last few days, we've released our agent API as well. But what got me started down this path was, I was a particle physicist, so I built deep underground dark matter detectors. And wow. I was a graduate student working on an experiment called Panda X. And it was a joint experiment between the US and China. And I was at University of Michigan doing my PhD there in physics. And we were partnering with universities in China. And the experiment was located in China as well. There are a lot of advantages to that. Things can move fast in China. Also, material cost is cheap in China, et cetera. And a lot of the folks who would actually build the lab and all the infrastructure around it, you know, it can move a lot faster, and you can keep the cost low in China. And so because of that, we were able to make the world's most sensitive detector in the mass range that we were looking at for this dark matter detector. And we did it in about 4 years, which is basically 3 times faster
unheard
than
of
any of our competitors. Yeah. And I was so lucky to be part of that. We were a really small team of around maybe 15 to 25 people. It kind of grew over time. But I didn't realize that I wasn't really quite aware, cognizant at the time of what was happening. But we had a budget of around like 20 to 25 million. And it's, you know, 15 to 25 people working over the span of like 4 years to build like the world's best thing in a deeply technical area. Sounds like a startup, doesn't it? You know?
Yeah.
And that's basically what it was. It was like this startup dark matter experiment that started from nothing, where we had to negotiate and figure out where to put the experiment, get the lab built. We had to do like the HVAC, like the air conditioning and heating and all sorts. We had to figure out everything. We had to get electricity there. We had to run our own fiber internet. We had to set up our own compute cluster underground. And underground is hot. We're 2 miles underground, and it's, you know, 90, 95 degrees, and then you have machines running in there. And so you have to get the heat out. And so anyway, you're in this very interesting situation. We had to problem solve and figure it all out. We had to simulate the experiment, then build the experiment, then run the experiment, then take data, then analyze the data, and then see if we have a world-class result. And we did have a world-class result. So that was really awesome. We were able to do it in such a short period of time. But one of the reasons that we were able to do it in such a short period of time is that the analysis phase didn't need hundreds or thousands of people to do it like many particle physics experiments would need. We used we only had a few people doing the analysis, and we used a lot of machine learning to help us. We simulated data, and we used a lot of machine learning in order to understand this large amount of data that we were taking with this experiment. And one very interesting thing about it is the type of data that we were taking was waveform data. It looks a lot like an audio signal. It wasn't an audio signal, but it was analog signals that looked a lot like an audio signal. And so we had all this experience just working with machine learning and this type of signal processing and trying to find interesting things happening in this data. And I thought it was just so cool that we were doing this. Like, who gets to do this? We're basically in a James Bond lair, 2 miles underground, building all this stuff. This is insane. And I'm just thinking we should like document this somehow, you know? And so that was myself and my co-founder, Noah, thinking about this. And we built a little device with a microphone, a battery, a Wi-Fi antenna, and just a little chip that is basically made out of a Raspberry Pi for anybody that's familiar with that. And we just recorded audio all day, every day, 24/7, you know, always going. And then it would upload to the cloud and just store the audio there. And after we did this for months, we accrued hundreds or, you know, over 1,000 hours of audio. We had a problem, which is we're not going to go back and listen to our lives again. That would take your entire life to do it. So that put us in analysis mode then. Well, how could we analyze this, like, you know, a few hundred hours or 1,000 hours of data? And maybe folks would think your first instinct is like, well, let's build something. But actually, as scientists, you're usually very pragmatic. You think, is there some other tool out there in the world that already does this? And so we went looking for that tool, and we found some of the legacy solutions. We found some of the large hyperscalers that were working on certain things. But when we looked at the capability of them, we were like, this doesn't match up with our experience in particle physics. What we were doing in particle physics is way more advanced than this speech technology that we're seeing. So after noticing that, we thought, wow, this is a massive opportunity for a company to start an end-to-end deep learning-based, data-driven audio AI company that can understand what's inside audio and then eventually produce it, and then eventually also just have entire conversations that are automated using this entire technique. And so we started working on that in 2015 we were a YC company. So we got investment for our seed for that. And then we built for those 4 years, like I talked about. And then once we released the product, now we're in this high growth mode where we have we raise a Series A, then we raise a Series B. And, you see the company, how it is now. We're around 100 people. And I think a really great group of folks who are just tackling a very difficult problem.
So there was inevitably a whole lot of complex problems that you had to figure out when you were putting a bunker underground and testing these physics particles. How do you go about solving these complex problems?
One of the most valuable tools in a physicist's toolkit is just starting from first principles. You just say, like, what are the laws of nature here? What are the possible energy scales or dollar scales or human hour scales? Or and then look at it from a practical perspective to what processors are available, how much memory storage is available, what has already been built by other people, et cetera. And you just kind of squint and look at the world and just say, okay, I think there's massive inefficiencies in this area. And so the areas where I think actually the world's kind of efficient, given the first principles way of looking at it, or the tools that have already been built or whatever, don't go innovate there. You know, don't do that. But then this other area where we see like an order of magnitude or two orders of magnitude or three orders of magnitude of inefficiency, that's where we're going to go. But usually where there's 10x or 100x or 1,000x efficiency gain, and it hasn't been done yet, that means that there's some kind of roadblock in the way, because otherwise people would have already done it, you know? And so that means you're signing up for like this hard battle. And for us, it was, you know, inventing the techniques for doing end-to-end deep learning for speech. But what that meant was not using any of the tools that were already built. So anybody who's familiar with speech from that time period would know that Gaussian mixture models were very popular. N-gram models were popular for language models. Way to finite state transducers were popular. There are all these mixtures of different components in a pipelined approach. And you basically just have to say, we're going to throw it all away. We're not going to use any of it.
This was after testing. This was after doing research, seeing that those weren't working.
We try all the different systems and we try to extract as much as we can in a short period of time. So think work on it for a few weeks, maybe a few months or something, right? And say, hey, can weighted finite state transducers do what we need? But it's not just do what we need today, it's do what we need 10 years from now, 5 years from now, because we want to bet on an underlying technology that will scale over a long period of time. It's not just, can we solve somebody's problem right now? If we were thinking about it from that perspective of, can we just solve somebody's problem right now? Anybody else can do that. The hyperscalers or whatever, that's what they're doing. We're thinking, no, we're starting a totally different company here, which is, a deep scientific technical bet that data-driven end-to-end deep learning is going to revolutionize how all this works. It's going to give you 10x, 100x, 1000x, different scaling. And if what we're working on doesn't have the potential to do that, why are we working on it? That doesn't make sense. I think there is, in any type of technology, there's a scientific phase and then there's an engineering phase. And in the scientific phase, you're talking about orders of magnitude. And in the engineering phase, you're talking about percents. And we're looking at the problem and saying, if this is just an engineering problem, there's no reason for us as scientists to be doing it. That doesn't make any sense, right? But if this is a scientific problem and we're discovering the fundamental laws of intelligence and we're applying them, using first principles, and thinking about the energy spend to do it and just all these principles, basically, then now that's something that's a job for us to do. If it's just, getting the next 30%, squeezing the next 30% out of a certain architecture or something like that, that I don't know. That's not my expertise. We have plenty of people now at DeepGram that do that kind of thing because our products, our speech to text is, now 9 years mature from where we started back then. But even then, we're still reinventing the architectures now, getting another order of magnitude or 2x or something like that. And that's the science phase. And then there's an engineering phase after that extracts the next bit of it. So we wouldn't pursue this problem if there wasn't a 10x involved, basically.
So one thing people frequently tell me they love about DeepGram is how fast it is. I think that is something that is undoubtable. Was that in your mind from the beginning, or when did you realize that was something that needed to be paramount to what you're doing?
Yeah, it was the most straight. So going back to, the early days in DeepGram and even now, it's one of the most striking things that you see when you try to use any tool, even a professional, API that was available then, or an open source tool, or you try to build it yourself using old techniques that use a beam search and that kind of thing. And you're like, oh my God, this is so slow. It's taking an hour to process an hour, or it's taking 20 minutes to process an hour. How is this a thing? There are many other more complicated things that we do in the world that do not take that amount of time to process. Also, just if you're thinking about what the world is going to need 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now, everybody is spending tons of compute to understand just a 1 hour meeting or something like that. It just doesn't make sense. it doesn't make sense from a dollar perspective. It doesn't make sense from a time perspective. So you have to just kind of trust that. One way I like to think about it is 30 years from now, do you believe that it's going to take 20 minutes to process an hour of audio? I do not believe that. No.
No way.
Now, 30 years from now, do you believe that it's going to be just as bad as it is now? I do not believe, from an accuracy perspective, I do not believe that. 30 years from now, do you think that these services are only going to support 30 languages or accents? No, I think it'll support thousands, right? So you start to, I think the 30 years timeline really helps you with breaking out of these percent type, improvements. And you say, another good way to think about it as a company is, well, 30 years from now, all of those things are going to be there. Are we going to be the company to create it? Because somebody's going to do it. Somebody's going to do it, but are we the ones to create it? Okay.
And if we are the ones to create it, we're the accelerators of creating it. Sure, 30 years from now, that may be the case just naturally. If we don't exist as a company, it might be 30 years from now that all that exists naturally. But what if we can make it exist in 10 years? You know, how much can the world benefit in the 20-year gap that you know, happened there? And these are the types of, like, dynamic range thoughts that I, you know, love to think about in the leadership in DeepGrab, but also just across the company for folks to, like, you have your day-to-day of your trying to achieve a certain, you know, goal, get a certain model out, get a certain product out, help certain customers get going, et cetera. You have to exist as a company, and not only that, you learn from your customers in this process, et cetera, but the whole time you should have a background process running saying, okay, in the next 6 months, we're going to throw all of this away and we're going to, you know, invent a totally new architecture for how this will work. And it will work the way we want it to work, not just are able to make it work right now. And so you have to constantly be reinventing and disrupting yourself and innovating in the company.
Yeah, it's almost like the idea that came to my mind was thinking about what it would be like, or what are almost like guarantees in your mind in 30 years, but then can you compress that down and do the whole accordion type thing and say, yeah, instead of 30 years, can we do it in 5, or can we do it in 6 months? Can we get something that is just so unreal, you would think it came from the future?
Yeah. Yeah. And take, you know, take that thought process, like, really seriously and say, you know, for instance, if you say, hey, we want to compress that down, assume you have the same number of human hours to produce it, right? So you say, okay, over time you organically, like, build a company and it goes from, you know, 10 people to 50 people to 100 people to 200 to 500 to 1,000 to whatever. Okay, well, you need to compress the hiring of all of those people. That might be your first thought, right? Then you say, well, do we really need to compress the hiring of people? We're an intelligence company. We're in a new phase. We're in the intelligence revolution. Actually, machines can provide intelligence and humans can provide intelligence. So we don't have to just use artisanal intelligence to build the company. We can use the machine intelligence to build the company as well. So could that be the thing that accelerates the timeline? And now if you're thinking that way, you back up in the system and say, okay, well, if we had the humans creating all the models and writing the documentation and doing all this, because this is what happens in companies, then what pieces of this are our biggest roadblockers? What portions of it can we automate? What portions of it can we insert machine intelligence in? What portions can we add essentially like a machine learning exoskeleton to the people who are in those positions, you know, in the company? And is that the thing that's going to accelerate us? And is it going to accelerate us 10%, 50%, 2x, 10x, 100x, or like, what's it going to be, right? And so but one of the most exciting things in the last, you know, decade that has been developed, and especially the last 2 years, I think everybody in the world is starting to realize that you can have agents, you can have machine learning. You can, I think a great way to think about this is it used to be that like 90%, maybe 60 to 90% of people in a company were not managers. Now everybody in a company is a manager. They're a manager of AI systems. And it, like that, that's just what the definition of an intelligence company is going to be. So constantly thinking about these things and trying to reinvent like your blockers and say, okay, these are a blocker. If we only use human intelligence to do it, well, what if we don't use only use human intelligence to tackle that problem? Okay, then we can come at it from a different angle. And again, I think it really helps to think in that 30-year time horizon. Well, if we don't, somebody else will, you know. So any kind of like you know, momentum that you have as a company that says, well, we have a great hiring pipe. This is just one example, but, you know, like we have a great hiring pipeline set up and we could just keep going that way. And we know that we would keep, you know, winning on that side for the next 3 years or whatever. Yeah, but 3 years in AI timeline is like 10 years in normal tech company timeline, you know? And if you're not building the machine intelligence acceleration into your company over those 3 years, and you're just doing it the old way, then you will just like be blindsided later on by a company that is doing it that way. So this is just one example, but there are many in the company in go-to-market, in product building, in customer success, in all sorts of areas.
So exactly, there's so many different vectors that you could pull on and try and think, how can I do like that fold time, or where you have the line that's going across the page and you say, yeah, it can actually touch the back if you just fold the page type thing. I want to go into, because you're talking about machine intelligence and you're talking about how to basically level up the company. One thing that I find fascinating about that is machine intelligence is one thing, but at DeepGram, it's probably one of the most humane places that I've worked at. Like, the human is very much considered in the working environment. And so when did the cultural aspect start to become something that was so important to you?
We're a learning company. And if we cease to be a learning company, then kind of the spirit has died at DeepGram. And I'll explain to you what I mean by that. Our humans learn, and we're constantly learning. In order to have humans learn and constantly be learning, you have to afford the opportunity for that. You have to afford the opportunity for mistakes a lot of times. And, you know, mistakes teach us a lot. You have to set aside budget to go after problems that are maybe too big and hairy, and you have to dial them back and whatnot. And then there are certain things where you have to be disciplined and think like more from like a hygiene perspective or something, like, hey, it's great to have artists and, you know, scientists and things like this, but also we have projects and we have customers and things need to end up on time. And so basically you're kind of bookended, you know, and you're doing this dance of working with your customers, having them help guide the product, and then they can, you know, through providing value to them, they fund the development and the rest of the company, and then we reinvest that back in. And then, yeah, so, but I think you just got to kind of look at the I know I was just talking about machine intelligence and human intelligence, and, you know, there's going to be a massive switch to a lot of intelligence being done by machines. But still, I believe that companies are, at least for the next 30 years, you know, beyond that, I'm not sure, you know, but at least for the next 30 years, companies, like, just look at the name of the company. It's like, like literally the word company is like a group of people, you know, trying to accomplish a task. That is still going to be the thing. And again, index back to what I was saying before about everybody's a manager now, you know, that's still going to be the case, that the novel, unique things in the world, humans are going to gravitate toward controlling, or, you know, that's where they're going to put their intellect into it. And so just like, you know, 200 years ago, a lot of folks might swing a sledgehammer to like lay down railroad tracks or something like that. But now we built machinery to like do that. And then that increases the productivity of the world. Yes, it's true that there are people that that were laying the railroad tracks then that, you know, immediately if you just designed a machine that did that for them, they would, you know, you would have like a, you'd have an unemployment problem for that particular sector, right? But these things happen gradually, and then people retool, and also generations happen, and their kids learn about new things, et cetera. And then we all benefit from like the productivity gain over time on average, you know. And so I'm constantly thinking about that in DeepGram, you know, how do I myself in my daily job, how do I put myself out of work with intelligence, but then learn a new thing? How do I delegate to others? Because I'm constantly trying to find world-class executors in DeepGram so that people in the company don't think, you know, Scott would be the best person for that job. No, I'd like, I want me to be to at least for every individual piece of DeepGram, there should be at least a person that everybody's like, whoa, you don't want Scott doing that. You want the expert doing that, right? You want the expert doing these things. You want that, right? And then I think, you know, you want everybody in the company kind of thinking that way, because then it propels you forward in this much faster arc. But I think also when you employ highly intelligent people, they're very satisfied in that environment then, because it isn't like, hey, it's 3 years later and I'm still doing the same job. What could I, you know, what am I going to learn? What am I going to do with my life? Because you're talking about really, you know, highly intelligent people, tons of horsepower. How do you keep them satisfied? Well, you keep them learning, you know, going back to what I was saying, you know, we're a learning company. Our machines learn, our humans learn. We're learning from our customers. Our customers are learning from us. We're educating them, et cetera. And so we can't ever lose that thread. But yeah, hopefully that gives you an idea of like where I come from. But then how do you actually build a culture for that? I think we are lucky in that myself, Adam Sipnevsky, our CTO, Noah, my other co-founder, several other people in Deepgram, especially in the, you know, the first like cohort of 10 or 20 people that worked at Deepgram. We all came from a very academic background, PhDs and, you know, postdocs and that kind of thing. And that type of environment, it is a very similar type of environment where learning is, time for learning is afforded, you know, crazy ventures are accepted, et cetera, but then you also need to deliver on timelines. And one thing that I think that is a little bit different about startups, though, is that in academia, you have to spend like 75% of your time begging for money. And in startups, you know, it's like 10% or less. So you actually, the fraction of time that you get to spend on like pushing the frontier is way higher in startups compared to academia. I wish that would change for academia. There's like some structural things that have to happen there. I would love for folks to not be saddled with that. But at least in startups, you don't have to do that. And so things can move very quickly. And especially in intelligence, you can see that now. Like, it's hard to compete with the startups in machine intelligence. If you're in academia, you basically have to focus on small data sets or, you know, novel small architectures or something like that, which are very valuable. But yeah, hopefully that gives you an idea. I would love to hear actually your thoughts on it, though, you know, because you're in it too. You know, I can say what I think about it, but yeah.
Well, from my perspective, you set the tone on the day that I joined, and I was given a video that said, here's the CEO, here's what the company's about, watch this video. And it was you eating like a ghost pepper and then trying to explain what the company is about and what we do and what the mission is. And it was almost like you saw an episode of Hot Ones and you were like, I'm going to do that to myself. I think that's what our onboarding video should be. Am I wrong there? Did you?
Pretty much. Yeah, it was that. And the same thing for customers, you know, try to get attention of the customer, you know, go to extremes, basically, right? What are some extremes that are acceptable, right? And that are relatable, you know? But yeah, and then put, also showing that like I'm willing to put myself in a stressful situation for Deepgram, you know, as hopefully I should be, you know, but also, you know, that is allowed at Deepgram to do some, pretty, you know, out there things. Like we send that video to prospects, you know, we still send that video to prospects and, yeah. And, but it is one of those things that's memorable, you know, saying, you know, for folks thinking like, there's something off about that company, but I like it. know? Like, it's not the same, just like exactly. You know, cookie cutter, like down the fairway, you know, way to do things. Like, no, we have that kind of artist, scientist, academic, like bend to what we do. Yeah.
It immediately gave me permission to be myself. That's the feeling that I took from it, was like, wow, if that's what our CEO is doing, then I can do what I do. And like, I don't have to try and fit into some mold that I think is needed, or the idea of the corporate whatever just went out the window. And so yeah. I really appreciated that as soon. And like I said, it was setting the tone from day one. The other piece that I'm absolutely in love with is it's remote first, and it has such a strong writing culture. And so you can always find docs. People are always asking for docs, referencing programs or referencing things. And that is such a blessing when you're a remote first culture. Like, the ability to not have to get on a call with someone when they need your help with things as the default, but as like, once you've exhausted all the other possibilities, for me is huge.
And then the fact that enables information retrieval, especially through like new intelligence systems, you know, before it might have been a standard search, right? But now you can use RAG type systems or, you know, embeddings and whatnot. So yes, we have large company, lots of documentation, many things going on. We record all of our internal meetings and everything as well. And so like, information is all over the place. But you can, a lot of times you can still find what you're looking for because of the intelligence tools that we either adopt from others that are building them, like
like our customers or other companies that are out there in the world, or that we built ourselves internally in order to allow that. The one thing that I really, really hate, like there's a, there, you know, that I just can't shake, and it, like it's something that I chase all the time, which is when you have a great idea, but you don't have a place to put it, or you don't have a place to see if other people have had that same idea. Or if you, you know, this is partially one of the reasons that we have so many Slack channels and DeepGram as well, that like, this is a great idea. We maybe should not do it right now. Okay. And I want everybody in DeepGram to be able to have this way of thinking. Right. And then you put it in the ice box, you put it in the parking lot, you know, whatever analogy you want to think about, but don't lose it, because those are like the little brilliant pieces that maybe it's, like this moment is not the exact time to do it, but maybe a week from now, maybe a month from now, maybe 2 years from now, et cetera, is the time to enact that. And then you kind of, this is a stupid analogy, but you know, the cicadas like rise out of the earth like 17 years later, all at the same time or whatever. If you actually have those little pieces of information stored around, you have them documented, you have people aware that it was talked about, you have all of this going on, then when the moment is there, then you can have it all come up at once. And like, for example, this is what happened with our TTS last year when, sure, you know, we had lots of different threads going on, but we tried not to lose any of the information over time. And then as soon as we're like, okay, the market is ripe now for TTS, let's go. Then that was what allowed us to release something very quickly with good quality.
Well, Scott, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for coming on here. This is really cool to have you doing this and sharing your origin story all the way to how you're building the company. And it gave me a whole new perspective on many different things.
Well, yeah, thanks so much for having me. You know, we are this remote first culture, but also we have an office in the Bay Area. We have an office in Ann Arbor, Michigan, near University of Michigan. And then we have an office in Texas too, in Austin. And so, you know, we're always happy to meet great people in those physical locations or online as well. We have a community that people can join, like a Discord server, and meet us, talk about, you know, using the service, or just meet us in general. You know, I'm pumped about the community that we're building there, and thanks for having me on.